Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Last night in Atlanta, debate number 5 for the Democratic presidential hopefuls.
No time to waste. Let's get right to it.
There are clearly two different set of rules for two different groups of people in America. The powerful people who, with their arrogance, think they can get away with this, and then everybody else.
But we cannot simply be consumed by Donald Trump.
I believe that abortion rights are human rights. I believe that they are also economic rights.
There's more than 100 years of Washington experience on this stage. And where are we right now as a country?
Though it was the Democrats' 5th debate, it was the first squarely in the shadow of the public impeachment hearings. They're all running against President Donald Trump, but each candidate also continues to face the challenge of convincing a critical mass of primary voters what they are running for. Who did that most successfully last night? And do these debates make much of a long-term difference? So this hour on Point, deconstructing the 5th Democratic debate. And you can join us on air or online on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, let's listen to a little bit of the candidates and how they responded to questions about the impeachment inquiry last night, because, of course, yesterday we had EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland providing some pretty eye-popping testimony about how much various members of the Trump administration, including the president himself, what they knew and what they did regarding pressuring Ukraine to have an investigation into the Bidens. So here is Senator Elizabeth Warren. She was asked last night in the debate if she would try to convince her Republican colleagues in the Senate, if indeed a trial happens in the Senate, to convict President Trump and remove him from office.
Of course I will. And the obvious answer is to say, first, read the Mueller report, all 442 pages of it that showed how the president tried to obstruct justice. And when Congress failed to act at that moment, it meant the president felt free to break the law again and again and again. And that's what's happened with Ukraine. We have to establish the principle no one is above the law. We have a constitutional responsibility and we need to meet it.
So that's Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren last night at the Democratic debate talking about her view that no one is above the law. And that was, of course, again, in response to the question of whether she would try to convince Republican colleagues in the Senate to convict President Trump if indeed there ends up being an impeachment trial in the Senate. Now, regarding impeachment, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders was also asked about this. He was specifically asked how focused he thinks Democratic candidates should be on the impeachment inquiry in the midst of an election. And here is how he answered.
What the American people understand is that the Congress can walk and chew bubble gum at the same time. In other words, we can deal with Trump's corruption, but we also have to stand up for the working families of this country. We also have to stand up to the fact that our political system is corrupt, dominated by a handful of billionaires, and that our economy is rigged with three people owning more wealth than the bottom half of America. We can do it all when we rally the American people in the cause of justice.
Well, joining us now from Arlington, Virginia, is Ginger Gibson. She's political correspondent for Reuters, and we have a link to her reporting at onpointradio.org. Ginger, it's great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, tell us what you thought of how the candidates, the Democratic candidates, handled these questions about impeachment, because as I mentioned at the top of the show, this was the first debate squarely in the shadow of some pretty intense public hearings that we've been having this week.
That's right. We saw a number of the candidates asked to weigh in on the impeachment question and to say not just whether they thought the president should be impeached, but to talk about how what this means for America and what they would do going forward. That was interesting. Joe Biden got asked sort of twice in the day to weigh in on this. We heard him say first that he thought that he could work to bring the Senate together to win Democratic races in swing states in order to make it so that after this, the people in the Senate who he once worked with and are now calling for investigations into him and his son could still be functioning and still be able to get things done. I also thought it was interesting, we heard him later in the debate, weigh in on whether or not President Trump should be prosecuted. Maybe what was one of his best debate answers so far, talking about how it would be up to his attorney general, that he wouldn't interfere in a prosecutorial decision making, but that he thought that chants like lock him up at rallies were distracting from what Democrats stood for, and that basically crowds should stop doing them.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so Biden having a good moment there. What about we heard Elizabeth clip from Elizabeth Warren, clip from Bernie Sanders, especially Sanders underscoring, his assertion, his belief that that the public needs to recognize, in his words, that that Democratic Congress can both hold impeachment inquiries or an impeachment hearing and, chew gum, do policy at the same time. Was he effective in delivering that?
Sanders throughout the night was one of the candidates who kept taking sort of purely sort of political questions or questions that seemed to be very political and trying to make them about policy. And that was his point. He said repeatedly that if Democrats spent all of the next year just talking about impeachment and not talking about issues and not talking about policy, that they would lose. We also saw that a little bit from Amy Klobuchar, who said, this is an economic question, not just a question about the president, and sort of talking about how Democrats needed to do both things. I think this is an important message for Democrats in a primary, particularly when they're talking to their own base. Something like they want rid of Trump is clearly a point at which they all agree. Otherwise, they all wouldn't be running against him. But when they're trying to get their own party to differentiate them between them, pointing to those policy differences is really important.
Right. I was just going to ask you that I'm not sure if a balancing act is the right metaphor here, but it's sort of a double message that they have to successfully deliver and carry with them whomever ends up being in the general election here. You mentioned Amy Klobuchar. And I just wanted to play a moment from her because she seemed to have a pretty strong night last night. She was asked about her electability, and she argued during the debate that female candidates are held to a different standard. And here's what Senator Klobuchar said.
I am the one, Mr. Vice President, that has been able to win every red and purple congressional district as the lead on a ticket every time. I govern both with my head and my heart. And if you think a woman can't beat Donald Trump, Nancy Pelosi does it every single day.
Senator Amy Klobuchar there. Ginger Gibson, I think she landed that line pretty well. But do you think that she did well enough to have folks who are especially looking for that sort of centrist, moderate candidate turn back towards her?
Well, what's clear for Amy Klobuchar is her time is going to start running out soon. But she's having her moment and maybe the best moment she could hope for. We've seen recent polls show her starting to climb in Iowa, which was always her sort of long-term plan. Build slowly in a state that neighbors her home state and then capitalize on that. So her performance in last night's debate was very well received. It was applauded by a lot of people. They thought she had several very good moments. But as we've seen in this process, people have bad debates and nothing happens. People have great debates and nothing happens. It's going to be about how she continues to convert that support on the ground. And the big question about this debate that I don't think any of us know was, did people watch hours of impeachment testimony yesterday and then go home, fix dinner, and turn to the impeachment, to the debate? And it's just a lot to take in, and we'll see for that reason how much it boosts or hurts any of the candidates.
Well, yesterday was a rather long day, even for the most politically voracious American, for sure. But Ginger, you also asked an interesting question there about, essentially you're asking, how much do these debates matter, right? Because if it's not so much debate performance that's nudging people up or down in the polls on the campaign trail, do all these debates matter?
They do matter. There are voters looking at them and using them to make decisions. And they're also important for Democrats who know that they're going to have to debate Donald Trump next year, not just on the, you know, three debate stages where the candidate will face off face-to-face. Every day on the campaign trail, every day that they're getting up on television, it's a really a year-long debate. And so this is the kind of practice they need. But it's also important to look at where they stand on issues, where they're able to differentiate themselves. So people are watching. We're watching. We talk about the invisible primary. This is still a bit of it, even if the voters aren't changing their minds based on it. But it's something that sort of gives the whole process direction. It would otherwise sort of run rampant, I think, without it.
So, Ginger, let me ask you something that I noticed last night. We've got Mayor Pete Buttigieg topping recent polls in both Iowa and New Hampshire, so squarely, in at least for this moment, in front-runner status. I didn't see his competitors going after him as much as they went after Senator Elizabeth Warren in the previous debate. I mean, it was a full pile-on on her then. Why didn't we see that same attack mode against Mayor Buttigieg?
I think there were two things at play here that kept Mayor Buttigieg from getting sort of the same kind of treatment that Elizabeth Warren got. The first is the moderators moderated this debate very differently than the first four that we watched. It was much brisker. They were moving much faster. And they were really often only letting two or three candidates weigh in on any issue and not trying to so directly prompt confrontation as we saw in previous debates. So you almost had to voluntarily go pick a fight with someone. And then we saw that they did serve one up to Kamala Harris to go after Pete Buttigieg on questions of race. They talked about her previous statements, his previous statements, and she didn't take it. It was a softball across the plate, and she opted not to swing. And one has to wonder if that's because what we saw with Warren, what we saw with Biden, those attacks backfired on the people giving them, and maybe that's made them a little less willing to levy them themselves now.
Well, we are talking about what happened in last night's fifth Democratic presidential debate. I'm joined by Ginger Gibson, political correspondent for Reuters. She's in Arlington, Virginia. So, Ginger, hang in there with us. We've got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are deconstructing last night's fifth Democratic presidential debate. And joining me today is Ginger Gibson. She's political correspondent for Reuters. She's with us from Arlington, Virginia. The debate last night was held in Atlanta at Tyler Perry Studios on a soundstage named for Oprah Winfrey. And so clearly, as we all know, and we've discussed quite a bit, African-American voters are critical in the Democratic primary process. They form an incredibly important part of the Democratic base, or I should say Democratic African-American voters here. So let's listen to a little bit about how the candidates discussed what they would do to meet the needs of Black voters. Here is a moment where former Vice President Joe Biden talked about his support, or the support he feels that he has from African-American voters, in response to a jab he received from Senator Cory Booker.
I have more people supporting me in the Black community that have announced for me because they know me. They know who I am. Three former chairs of the Black Caucus, the only African-American woman that ever been elected to the United States Senate, a whole range of people.
No,
my point
that's
is,
not true. The other
that's
one
not
is
true.
Here.
I said the first. I said the first African-American elected. First African-American.
The other one is here. That was Senator Kamala Harris, standing right next to Joe Biden. Well, joining us now is Aisha Moody Mills. She's with us from New York. She's a Democratic political strategist, former executive director of the Congressional Black Caucus PAC, former regional finance director of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. She was also the first African-American woman to lead a national LGBTQ organization as president and CEO of the LGBTQ Victory Fund and Institute. Aisha Moody Mills, it's great to have you back on Point.
I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's wonderful to have you. So first of all, what's your take on how the candidates addressed both the importance and the needs of Democratic African-American voters?
Yeah, it's about time. I mean, the reality is that Black voters are going to determine this, at least in the earliest states, Black voters are going to determine the primary outcome. And it has been a travesty, I believe, that we have done so much highfalutin talking to this supposedly movable middle, this gray area that Joe Biden likes to play in, and really taking Black voters for granted and not speaking directly to their issues. And so I thought that it was great that on the debate stage, Kamala and Cory both kind of reclaimed the community, if you will, not that they were ever detached from it. But when Cory Booker talks about marijuana legalization, he's specifically speaking to issues that matter to Black folks. When Kamala Harris calls out the fact that you can't just win us over by going and knocking on the Black church door six weeks out, and then pretty much throwing shade to Mayor Pete because he's had so many issues with Black voters, it's important because Black people are listening to the fact that they're being spoken to and not just danced around. And so I think that all of these candidates need to really get right with the fact that the early states in particular, South Carolina, and then on Super Tuesday, you have so many southern states that have very high African-American percentages in terms of the Democratic primary electorate. And if Black people don't come out and support, you're not going to win the nomination.
So, Aisha, before the break, Ginger Gibson was telling us about her take on why the other candidates didn't go after Pete Buttigieg as much as maybe one might have expected. I mean, especially given the issues that his campaign has had very recently with African-American voters, right? I mean, like using stock photos of African-Americans and putting out that list of 400 influential African-Americans who ostensibly supported him, but really it was an opt-out email that they had to click on. I mean, why do you think that Senator Harris, when she was given a softball on that one, she declined to swing?
You know, it's interesting how people pick and choose who they're going to go after. I think you can tell how serious the contenders take their fellow contenders based upon how aggressively they go after them. Look, Elizabeth Warren clearly is the only person in the race who has really just surged and surged and surged over time. And her support is very strong across the board. And so people realize that she actually is a big threat, quote unquote, in this race and attacked her. I'm not sure that people take Pete seriously. If you notice what happened on the debate stage, people are still throwing a lot of shade on at him, including the moderators, by the way, about the number of votes he even had to have in order to be elected mayor, kind of trivializing the size of South Bend, highlighting the fact that, like, he's had marginal relationships with African Americans because he's from South Bend, Indiana, and don't know any. And the ones that are in his city, frankly, have had a lot of negative things to say about him. I think that he is trying to cast himself as this connector because he is this Midwest guy, and other folks are shutting him down because he hasn't had much of a constituency in his career and just isn't necessarily connected to the heart and soul and base of the Democratic Party. So I think that that strategy of marginalizing Pete and ultimately highlighting that he may have a lot of money because he's the cool, young, you know, kind of cute, gay thing on the, you know, kind of out there and donors are throwing money at him. But marginalizing his experience is actually the strategy, whereas you have to come for someone like a Joe Biden or an Elizabeth Warren that has a very long track record and certainly has like deeper roots in the base communities of the Democratic Party.
OK, so Ginger Gibson, I'm going to turn to you here in a second. But first of all, I want to play a moment from the debate last night where Mayor Pete Buttigieg, he took the opportunity to address his lack of support, his pretty profound lack of support from Democratic African-American voters. And he did so by trying to bridge his experience as a gay man in America with the experience of African-Americans. And here's what he said.
While I do not have the experience of ever having been discriminated against because of the color of my skin, I do have the experience of sometimes feeling like a stranger in my own country, turning on the news and seeing my own rights come up for debate, and seeing my rights expanded by a coalition of people like me and people not at all like me, working side by side, shoulder to shoulder, making it possible for me to be standing here wearing this wedding ring in a way that couldn't have happened two elections ago.
Ginger Gibson, was that effective?
You know, it's an interesting attempt that he made here to say, I don't understand what you're going through, but here is what I'm going through. And his campaign had said all along that they thought that he could appeal to African-Americans by talking about his own experiences and his own issues and fighting for his own rights. However, that answer was met with really mixed response last night. There was a good deal of criticism that people thought he was failing to understand the long-term and systemic racism that continues to plague African-Americans in the United States, that it did not fairly understand how the two were not related. And then there were others who said, you know, that was a good response. It was a good way to get to something that he personally understands. And he didn't trivialize the suffering of African-Americans. I suppose you're never going to please anyone. And if you're running for president, that's probably the first lesson you need to learn. But this is his attempt. The real issue, and I think Aisha sort of made this point, but to echo it, is that these candidates need Black voters. And it's clear across the board, they're not all sure what to do to get them. We see different attempts. We see Booker trying to say, look, you guys, Biden is not who you think he is. He's you know, he's not behind us in the issues that we need him to be behind us. But that argument so far hasn't worked. And so we see a real struggle. How do you attack? How do you sell yourself? What do you do? What issues are you talking about? And polls that over the course of these debates have just not really budged, despite repeated overtures.
Aisha, are we seeing here the limits of Pete Buttigieg trying to, effectively use identity when what voters are really looking for, and I've heard this particularly from African-American voters, are like, what's the meat of the policy? Like, what are you actually going to do? Not so much, who are you?
No, not at all. Identity politics matters and is very important. So I don't want to trivialize identity politics. And what I mean by that is that being a Black person, as I am in America, has come with lots of consequence. We are a resilient people. We see our democracy with, I would argue, so much more reverence than the average citizen because we have had to fight tooth and nail to be a part of it. And so showing up in our country as someone who has been marginalized because of identity and then find strength through identity is very much something that all these candidates need to understand. And when we circumvent that just to want to whitewash, frankly, our narratives about politics and policy and try to universalize ideas, what we do is we discount real lived experience of people that is critical and important and absolutely colors the way that we vote, frankly. The challenge with Pete, and I caveat this by saying I have a lot of respect for Mayor Pete. I gave him his first national platform when he came out when I was the president and CEO of the LGBTQ Victory Fund. We had him come and keynote our big national brunch. And I'm highlighting that because the challenge that he faces is that he is a white man in America by every single by every single kind of like, you know, check mark for that. Pete didn't come out until he was in his 30s. Mm-hmm. He knows no life of suppression, if you will, of marginalization, of, you know, homophobic animus that is in any way derailed him. And that is evidenced by his life. The guy went to Harvard. He is a Rhodes Scholar. And in fact, Rachel Maddow on MSNBC, when he did his first interview with her, asked him about this. She's like, hey, 10 years before you, I was the first gay Rhodes Scholar from the United States. 10 years later, you became a Rhodes Scholar and you still weren't out. So much had changed culturally. What's your deal? Right. Like, and so I think that, you know, and then he went on to become mayor. He was not an out gay man when he became mayor. He came out right before he essentially started his like national political life. And so I think that the challenge that he faces is going to be one of, if he is going to lean deep into identity of being a gay man in America, that can't come across as, well, I'm playing this card even though my entire life experience has been privileged white man.
Interesting.
And that's where we get into a rub where you have African Americans who kind of raise their eyebrow and say, well, you weren't exactly quite in these trenches. I don't really quite understand, you know, you're trying to connect with me around identity. And even his policy stuff, you know, the Douglas plan seemed to be robust. But then you have people who are kind of, you know, picking it apart and saying this actually doesn't quite get to the heart and soul of the issues black people are facing, too. So I think that identity politics, you know, the moral of the story here is that identity politics matter. And frankly, white identity politics have been the foundation of our American democracy to our detriment from the beginning of the founding of this country. Mm. So I wouldn't discount that. But I would offer that, you know, Mayor Pete trying to leverage identity politics isn't really landing at all.
Interesting. Okay, well, speaking of Rhodes Scholars, let's listen to a little bit more from also Rhodes Scholar Senator Cory Booker and how he addressed African American voters and their importance in the Democratic primaries. And here's what he said last night.
I have a lifetime of experience with black voters. I've been one since I was 18. Nobody on this stage should need a focus group to hear from African American voters. Black voters are pissed off and they're worried. They're pissed off because the only time our issues seem to be really paid attention to by politicians is when people are looking for their vote. And they're worried because the Democratic Party, we don't want to see people miss this opportunity and lose because we are nominating someone that isn't trusted, doesn't have authentic connection.
Senator Cory Booker last night in the fifth Democratic presidential debate. Ginger Gibson, I actually thought that Senator Booker did quite well last night, but he still doesn't seem to be breaking through for some reason. What's going on there?
It is a fascinating answer to listen to from Booker. You're right. That was a very good answer. He had a number of very good moments. He said voters need to feel that their candidates are authentic. And the problem is they're not feeling that he's authentic. He, particularly when he talks about African-American voters, polling at like 0% in South Carolina, despite having spent a good deal of time, energy and money campaigning in the state. So he's got the problem, right? He hasn't I think, at least up till now, identified a solution to try to overcome that problem that he's facing. He has long had a struggle, I think, with authenticity. And, you know, when I covered him in New Jersey, when I worked at the Star-Ledger, he had a line. He would joke about how he liked shakes and was a vegan and was quite different than the other person that was on stage with him. And it's sort of always been a joke about how he's a little different. I think he's trying to find a way to be sort of his authentic self, and it's still not there, but he does appear to see that that's what he needs to be.
Mm. Well, so we've talked a lot about South Carolina and its importance in this primary cycle. The South Carolina primary is on February 29th of 2020. Of course, Iowa is on February 3rd, New Hampshire on February 11th. But guess what? Before South Carolina, we have the Nevada Democratic caucuses on February 22nd. We don't talk about Nevada enough. So let's go to Las Vegas right now and check in with Megan Messerly. She is political reporter for the Nevada Independent. Megan, it's great to have you back on the show. Welcome back.
Wonderful. Thanks for having me.
Okay. So obviously, because of the importance of African-American voters, we've been talking a lot about South Carolina. But what's happening right now out in Nevada? The Nevada caucuses are a week before South Carolina. So what's the mood and the feel amongst Democratic voters right now?
Yeah, it's been really interesting to see how the race has been playing out here, because we are the first really diverse state to vote in the early nominating process, right? You have Iowa and New Hampshire that are essentially 90% white. Nevada is not. It's about 50-50. We have a huge community of Latino voters here. The AAPI community is growing, a significant Black community as well. So it's been interesting to see how the candidates are reaching out really to a diverse constituency and how they're performing among that constituency. We've seen here actually in a couple of recent polls that have come out over the last couple of weeks, former Vice President Joe Biden has been leading by about 10 points over Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. And that kind of makes sense, right? He has these longstanding relationships. And when you dig into the crosstabs, you see that, you know, these candidates have a lot of room to grow, right? Especially with voters of color. There are a lot of folks that still don't know who Elizabeth Warren are, especially looking at specifically Latino and voters that identify as non-white. The same is true. You all were talking about Mayor Pete Buttigieg. He's the same issue here. He's pulling a little bit lower, around 7%, sort of the high single digits here. But we've seen that the numbers show that as well. He's still, people just don't know who he is, right? And especially voters of color don't know who he is. So he has a lot of, you know, room to grow to make those, you know, meaningful, authentic connections if he really does want to have success in a diverse state like Nevada, and then go on, obviously, to South Carolina.
Megan, we have just about 40 seconds before we have to take a quick break here. But I recall that former Senator Harry Reid of Nevada, he recently said that he doesn't think it matters at all what happens in New Hampshire and Iowa because they're not necessarily representative of the diversity of the country. And he says the press focuses on those two states to the detriment of the nation. Is that how Nevadans feel?
He did. And definitely. I mean, I think we value our place in the early nominating process, right? But we'll have to see how the candidates actually perform here, because that's more representative of how they're going to perform overall with the Democratic electorate, as opposed to how they do in Iowa, New Hampshire.
So Megan Messerly, Ginger Gibson, and Aisha Moody Mills, stand by. We are trying to deconstruct last night's fifth Democratic presidential debate. We'll talk a lot more about what the candidates said about the economy and about foreign policy when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are deconstructing last night's fifth Democratic presidential primary debate. I'm joined today by Aisha Moody Mills. She's a Democratic political strategist, former executive director of the Congressional Black Caucus PAC, and the first African-American woman to lead a national LGBTQ organization as the president and CEO of the LGBTQ Victory Fund and Institute. Ginger Gibson joins us as well. She's a political correspondent for Reuters. And Megan Messerly is with us. She's a political reporter for the Nevada Independent. So let's listen to a little bit of the back and forth on the issue of taxes and the economy from last night's debate. Here's Senator Cory Booker really pushing Senator Elizabeth Warren on her proposed wealth tax.
It's cumbersome. It's been tried by other nations. It's hard to evaluate. We can get the same amount of revenue through just taxation. But again, we as Democrats have got to start talking not just about how we tax from a stage, but how we grow wealth in this country amongst those disadvantaged communities that are not seeing it.
And here's how Senator Elizabeth Warren responded to Senator Booker.
The top 0.1% that I want to say pay 2 cents more, they'll pay 3.2% in America. I'm tired of freeloading billionaires. I think it's time that we ask those at the very top to pay more so that every single one of our children gets
a real chance. Everybody is tired of freeloading billionaires. Everybody's tired of corporations getting away with paying zero taxes.
That's Senator Booker and Senator Warren last night. Megan Messerly, let me turn back to you in Las Vegas, because after, you know, Iowa and New Hampshire, Nevada has a more diverse electorate. I'm reading here that Nevada Democrats are more likely to be members of unions. I know that when the candidates have come to Las Vegas, for example, they speak directly to, say, the powerful culinary unions there. I'm wondering how Nevadans respond to the economic plans that we've seen from the candidates and how they're talking about them in the debates.
Right. So I think you have to think about this from a couple different perspectives. One is that, you know, the recession is still very fresh in a lot of people's minds, right? Nevada was hit hardest by the housing crisis, and the memory of that
Absolutely.
Still lingers here, right? Even though, you know, we're recovering, you can drive around Las Vegas and see the homes being built again. But that's still a fresh memory for
a
lot of people.
I mean, it left a major crater in people's lives
there,
for sure.
It did. So I think that's one of the sort of background items that plays into this. And the other one is you have to think about sort of this Western ethos that we have right in Nevada, which is that you sort of live and let live, right? We don't have a state income tax. We're still very reticent as a state government to raise taxes. It's this, you know, thorny question that no one wants to have at the legislature because it's still just not politically popular. Not that it's ever fun to raise taxes, but here I think we have even more of a knee-jerk reaction to it. So I think some of that plays into this conversation, right? When you hear about, you know, taxes, whether it be a wealth tax like Senator Warren has proposed, I think some of that concern plays into it. You think about Nevada being a blue state, right? We've gone blue in the last two elections here, but that doesn't necessarily mean we're necessarily a progressive state, right? We in the last election elected a fairly moderate Democratic Governor Steve Sisolak, a fairly moderate U.S. Senator Jackie Rosen. So even though we're trending blue, we're not necessarily progressive, and so I think you're going to see some differences of opinion when it comes to, you know, what is the right level of taxation? You know, what are we comfortable with? Certainly there's, I think, more support for something like what Senator Warren is talking about, where you're just going after, you know, the richest of the rich. But it's still not, you know, sort of homogenous opinion among folks here.
This is so interesting. Aisha, let me turn back to you on something, because so we've got Iowa, we've got New Hampshire, and then hearing Megan talk about sort of the dynamism of the Democratic electorate in Nevada and then moving to South Carolina. It seems as the two earliest states right now, as of this moment, you know, perhaps they would favor Pete Buttigieg or Elizabeth Warren. Then Vice President Joe Biden's polling well in both Nevada and sort of hanging on in South Carolina. Long story short, Aisha, I wonder if you see a long primary process rolling out, you know, as we dive into next year.
I am already exhausted, as I'm sure that you guys are. We're only five debates in, and we haven't, to your point, you know, even started any of the primaries. Yeah, this is gonna be a long haul, and it's gonna be a long haul because you have several contenders. Well, I'd say at least three who have the resources to really compete and to drag this on and on. So what generally happens is that you go into February and you have those early states of Iowa, New Hampshire, and you got now you have Nevada, and you have South Carolina, and then Super Tuesday hits at the beginning of March. And once you get through all those contests, people kind of look at themselves and they say, all right, I'm not going to really be able to compete in a way that I can try to find and scrape together the delegates that will take me to the nomination, so I'm going to bow out. Well, that's not going to happen this time because Pete Buttigieg, Bernie Sanders, and Elizabeth Warren, at least those three, will have the resources to duke it out till convention, I imagine, just because they're raising money hand over fist.
And then you have Joe Biden, who seems to be, you know, the billionaire boy. And so the rich part of the Democratic Party will do what they can to prop him up just for the sake of it. And so he's going to also stick around no matter how much money he has. He's got polling, et cetera. So these are people who are going to be fighting, you know, fighting it out until the end because they can afford to. And that is something that'll be interesting. You know, we saw that play out with Bernie Sanders and with Hillary Clinton. We saw it play out with Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. So it's going to be long. And because we have so many more people this time that can afford to stretch it out, I think we all need to just hold on for the ride because it'll be really interesting. And I think that's a good thing to some degree because now states that come a little later that always don't get to be heard from and be talked about in the primary process might, right? So you just never know what's going to happen as we get into the late spring.
But it does just get longer, more expensive, and more exhausting every 4 years, I feel like. Well, I want to turn back to what we heard last night in the debate and just touch on a moment regarding foreign policy because Senator Kamala Harris – she really had deep criticism of Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard's view on foreign policy over her record, really, on foreign policy. And here's what Senator Harris said.
It's unfortunate that we have someone on the stage who is attempting to be the Democratic nominee for president of the United States, who during the Obama administration spent 4 years full time on Fox News criticizing President Obama.
And here's how Representative Gabbard responded.
Senator Harris is doing is unfortunately continuing to traffic in lies and smears and innuendos because she cannot challenge the substance of the argument that I'm making, the leadership and the change that I'm seeking to bring in our foreign policy, which only makes me guess that she will, as president, continue the status quo, continue the Bush-Clinton-Trump foreign policy of regime change wars, which is deeply destructive.
That's Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard last night in the Democratic debate. Ginger Gibson, let me just ask you about Senator Harris, because, you know, we're talking about this different primary calendar this time. California's moved way up. And yet still, just like with Cory Booker, Senator Harris is having continuing trouble breaking through. I mean, is her campaign in its last gasp, and why?
She's trying to find a way to turn things around. That answer that she gave regarding Congressman Gabbard was really scathing. It was maybe one of the most scathing responses that we've seen so far in one of these debates. She sort of just tore into her. And Tulsi might be an easy target. There is a shared belief among those candidates that they're not big fans of her. If the establishment of the Democratic Party doesn't like someone, we could probably agree that they don't really like Tulsi Gabbard. But that's not what's going to pull her poll numbers around. That's not what's going to get Harris into first place in California, of which every poll we've seen so far, she has not been, even though it is her home state. She's going to have to make some other changes. We've seen her try to make changes to her staff. We've seen her try to make changes to where she's campaigning. But she continues to struggle. And I know, I think Aisha made a great point about these candidates and how long they can last and who's going to have money. But I would also venture that sometimes the other factors, even if they have money, will start to weigh in. I mean, Kamala Harris has more money than Joe Biden does in her bank account. But if she can't get her poll numbers up, she could be very short for the race at this point.
Megan, let me ask you, I should have asked this earlier, and I'm sorry I didn't, but when you said that Joe Biden's doing well in Nevada, why is that? What are voters saying about why at this point in time they're looking to Mr. Biden?
Yeah, I think it's a couple of factors. I think, you know, one, just the way we've seen the race, you know, play out, candidates spending their time, obviously a lot of time in Iowa, New Hampshire, not as much time here. I think some people are still getting to know some of these newer candidates. I also think it kind of plays into what I was talking about earlier with this fact that Nevada has trended blue, but it's not really a progressive state per se. And the folks that Democrats have tended to elect here in recent years have really been more moderate. And so it kind of makes sense then when you think about, you know, why there's some support for Joe Biden here, maybe above an Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders. But it also makes you wonder sort of how that plays out right over the next couple of months if they're looking for a moderate candidate. And if Joe Biden continues to flag in some of these other states, does that hurt him here? And then who are voters turning to? Are they turning to Mayor Pete? And how does that play out here?
Okay. So, Aisha, we actually did a show a couple of days ago about actually on Monday of this week about the late entrance into the Democratic field, specifically former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick. But I asked a question on Monday that I'd love to hear your view on, because, you know, this question of are voters looking for a moderate, are voters looking for someone who's electable, are voters looking, Democratic voters, I should say, are they looking for someone who can beat Donald Trump? Or there does also seem to be pretty ample evidence that voters who consider themselves centrist still want big ideas too. So, I mean, this seems to be a fundamental tension that we even saw last night on the debate stage. How's it going to work itself out?
All right. So don't believe the hype. This has not a damn thing to do with voters. Let's just start there. There is a billionaire boys club. Frankly, all the people that are afraid to death of Elizabeth Warren, who have been the bankrollers of the Democratic Party for some time, the Wall Street, you know, deep pocket, deep moneyed folks, who really, really, really are afraid of losing their stature, their power, their wealth, right? So this is the Jeff Bezoses. This is the Michael Bloomberg crew. These are all the people who thought that Joe Biden was going to be their savior until they realized that he's not raising money at the clip that they had hoped he would. And so they're looking for an alternative who's going to be really friendly to them. And the truth is that what is happening that is infuriating me is that every single poll shows that voters think that the field that we have is overwhelmingly too big at this point, but certainly has good candidates in it, and Democrats are fine with the field that we have. This has nothing to do with voters. It has to do with a donor class that wants to preserve their way of life, that is now essentially who has always, frankly, the way this has worked, as Elizabeth Warren talked about, is they've always leveraged their dollars to get their candidate, right? They've leveraged their dollars to support the person that they wanted in the White House at the end of the day. And now, because of the way that this is playing out and the fact that the voters are more powerful and interested in candidates with big, bold ideas and not just, you know, the people who can write the check, they are getting anxious that their power is kind of shifting. And so they are trying to pick and choose and determine for the Democratic voters who their candidate should be, which is why you have this kind of off the wall jumping in now of these new moderate, you know, billionaire class types as honestly, you know, kind of an alternative to Joe Biden, who some people are skeptical about whether he's going to be able to pull it out.
And that's
problematic.
I just got to jump in here because, I mean, I hear your fire and passion about the donor class here, but we are hearing the same line about, you know, about finding that moderate path from the man who is emblematic of hope and change himself, from President Barack Obama. I mean, he was just talking a couple of days ago about how you got to stay tethered to reality.
You used the right language when you just described my favorite president and human ever, Barack Obama, is that he absolutely was the hope and change candidate. But I don't think that anyone would confuse his presidency with being the most progressive one. And that's where we are with this different line of what we're talking about. Love Barack Obama. Wonderful, wonderful president. But there is right now a fundamental kind of philosophical divide happening in the party. And it is the still to some degree the kind of new Dem, pro-business, kind of wealthy, you know, leading us all to some promised land kind of sect and group, right? The moderate middle, which ultimately means the business-friendly community. Right. When people are talking about moderate. And then you have a more progressive and visionary sense of like the people having power. And those two concepts have been a bit diametrically opposed. And we're seeing that tension play out on the stage. We're seeing it play out in the differentials with the candidates. We are also reminded then of just structurally the Democratic Party and what it has looked like under the Clintons. Mm-hmm. And then Obama as a disruptor, being a disruptor did not make him a social Democrat. Right. Like being a disruptor made him an African-American who got elected. But in terms of his policies, he wasn't an Elizabeth Warren. And so I think that's the differentiator that you're seeing play out.
Ginger Gibson, I hear what Aisha Moody Mills is saying, but maybe also President Obama's presidency is evidence for a lot of voters about why revolution is not what they're looking for, but evolution. Because look at all the cost that it took Obama, what it costed President Obama to get the Affordable Care Act across the line.
I think you make an excellent point. Ayesha, I think, is right that the Democratic Party at this point could be divided into two camps. But I think the division into two camps is those who want to burn everything down and start over, and those who think that burning things down is what Trump has tried to do and it hasn't worked, and they want to go back to a calm or a sort of a civility that is no longer here. And I have to tell you that when I talk to voters, there is quite a division among voters, but don't doubt that there are not a large number of voters who tell me I want calm, who when I'm standing in parking lots in Iowa or Ohio or Florida, places that I go and stand and talk to voters, that they tell me that they want to not feel like they have to watch the evening news anymore, that they feel like they don't want a president who tweets all the time. It is not an insignificant population. Now, when you talk to young people, when you talk to progressives, they want to burn the whole place down. And that's why they're voting for Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. But to me, that's the real division that the Democratic Party is trying to figure out.
Well, Ginger Gibson, political correspondent for Reuters, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Megan Messerly, political reporter for the Nevada Independent. It was great to have you. With your permission, we'd love to check in with you again as we get closer to the Nevada Democratic caucuses.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Megan. And Ayesha Moody Mills, Democratic political strategist and former executive director of the Congressional Black Caucus PAC. Ayesha, it is fabulous to have you on the show, as always. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Glad to be here.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.